This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Historian Harry Jones says there were no losers in the Civil War. He says both sides won, and that is because the war formed a more perfect union by securing freedom for millions of Americans. Harry Jones is an independent history consultant and former assistant director and curator at the African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum in Washington, D.C. He's going to be at Fayetteville State University next week to deliver a presentation called How the Civil War Made America Great. And he joins us now. Harry Jones, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us about, obviously the Civil War corrected a great wrong in the American social and political order, but you say it made America great. Tell me more.
Well, the process by which it corrects the great wrong is in league with the Constitution. When you look at the abolitionist movement within the African-American community, by 1840s, the leadership is very clear that they believe that the Constitution is essentially anti-slavery, and that working in league with that Constitution, they can end the tyranny of slavery. And one of the best examples of what I'll call a conversion is Frederick Douglass, who was really a secessionist, a Garrisonian, William Lloyd Garrison follower, who believed the Constitution was pro-slavery and really believed in secession. But after 1848, he says, well, I see in this preamble some very clear goals that can be used for emancipation. So what happens is that the Constitution is used to emancipate a disenfranchised enslaved population.
Well, let's talk. This is interesting because this will foreshadow an argument in the later civil rights movement in the 1950s and late 1940s. That leads to Brown versus the Board of Education, an argument within African American communities about whether you should go for the separate or the equal. Let's be separate, but let's make them live up to the equal part of that. And ultimately, the decision going forward was there will be no equality if we are separate, right? And you're saying that this was essentially an argument that was going on in the pre-emancipation era as well.
Correct. In the most important interpretation in the pre-emancipation era is that the Constitution addresses us all as persons, whether you were held for your labor or not. So we're all persons. We're all Americans. So we get rid of these convenient classifications of black and white. I call them convenient, but they're actually quite a cancer to our society.
Right. But also the Constitution in some ways enshrines slavery by making some of those persons three-fifths of a person.
Well, it doesn't really make them three-fifths of a person. In fact, this is an interesting little equation here, because what it does, it gives those who hold them as slaves three-fifths more power than they would have had they not been counted at all. So three-fifths of a person was better than five-fifths when it comes to political power. So they got three-fifths more electoral votes in the Electoral College, three-fifths more representatives. So it's not really three-fifths of a person. It's really three-fifths of the power that slaveholders get within the Republic.
So this is interesting. What you're saying here is that it was, in fact, built into the foundation of this country, and the Civil War simply makes good on a promise that's already enshrined in this document.
And that is what you find is the consistent argument of African-American leadership leading up to and through the Civil War.
You say one of the best things that happened during the Civil War was Robert E. Lee's victory over George McClellan in the Peninsula Campaign. You might have to tell us a bit about that Peninsula Campaign and then why that victory would be so important.
Well, Lee's competence is a great contributor to emancipation. When the Civil War began, it was illegal for men of African descent to join the federal army. It had been illegal since 1792. And McClellan had assembled, arguably, the best trained and best equipped army in the world in June of 1862. And he led that army to within 12 miles of the rebel capital, Richmond, Virginia. On June 1st, Robert E. Lee takes command of the rebel forces. Lee has less than half the size of McClellan's forces. He's able to deceive and outmaneuver McClellan, and by the first week of July 1862, McClellan is in full retreat, suffering a humiliating defeat, and he's asking for more troops. Well, the response from Congress is two very important pieces of legislation. One is the Militia Act of 1862, which granted President Lincoln the authority to receive men of African descent into all armed services of the United States. And the second piece of legislation is the Second Confiscation Act, which declared forever free in Section 9 all persons held as slaves by supporters of the rebellion. So it's Lee's success in the Peninsula Campaign, forcing McClellan to withdraw, McClellan's failure, that actually leads to this very important, these very important pieces of legislation that find themselves in the Emancipation Proclamation.
The fact that these laws had to be passed in the 1860s points to something else that you underscore in all of your talks and in the work that you do, which is the North wasn't too much better than the South when it came to its understanding of African Americans.
Oh, this is true. In fact, interestingly, in 1860, when the Civil War began, not only were African Americans prohibited from serving in the in state militias, oh, in the federal militia, but they also prohibited from serving in state militias except for the state of North Carolina.
This is now this I did not know. Tell me more about this.
So you could serve if you could be if you were a free man, a free Negro, a free person of mixed blood, you could serve in the state militia of North Carolina, but you could not serve in the state militia of Massachusetts. Mm.
And this also talks about after the war, I think some of the same things are true and pretty clearly illustrated. We think about the changes in the way, obviously, the outcome of the Civil War changed things in the South, but you say that also had an impact on the North.
Well, let's take Illinois, for example. You had black laws. The black laws in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio prohibited black men from voting. The Civil War gets rid of that.
You in all of this, though, and we talk about Reconstruction, you're talking about making the point that the Civil War, because of all these things, because of these changes in turn, make America great. But so much backsliding, certainly here in the South, but also up North, that took place. I mean, I wonder if you can really hold that argument very long.
Well, we do not have a positive curve. Everything just doesn't go, you know, just this wonderful positive curve. It's a very wavy curve. It's ups and downs. However, what we do have put in place are methods or instruments in order to get to a better space. And so we are better off in 1877 than we were in 1857. So even though we call, say Reconstruction failed, well, you can track some African American families, businesses, et cetera, and find out and find that no, it actually it succeed. They have succeeded ever since. And when we look at the modern civil rights movement, we must go back in history and look at what happened before and what they are actually using that was put in place long before many of the leaders were born.
I think that's a very important point. I'd like you to talk more about it and give us some of the details. We do think when we say the civil rights movement, we're thinking about something that began pretty much in the 1950s. But you say it does date back to Reconstruction when some of these changes were made structurally. Talk about some of those changes and how they led to and how they were built on to become what we call the civil rights movement.
Well, two of the most important pieces of legislation more important pieces, amendments to the Constitution, is the 14th and 15th Amendments. Equal protection under the law. You get birthright citizenship. And then the 15th Amendment, the recognition that only men could vote then, that you could not be denied your right to vote based on race, creed, or color. Well, this, of course, would be used throughout the civil rights movement. These would be arguments consistently made. And the 14th Amendment had these enforcement sections to it that were very important. You saw it used actually in 1871, 3 years after it was ratified. And it could have been used later, but there are certain components to it. For example, if you're depriving citizens of their right to vote, you can go with a Voting Rights Act like we did in 65, but you could also give the president enforcement authority, and you go to the states that are depriving those citizens of the right to vote, and those states then can have their electorals and representatives taken away based on the number of citizens they're depriving the right to vote. That's in the 14th Amendment, this instrument that's in place. Also, when I say in 1871, you have a piece of legislation that's also often referred to as the anti-Klan legislation. And what it did, it lifted the writ of habeas corpus and gave General Grant the authority to send his spies, if you will, inside the Klan, and really gets rid of the first Ku Klux Klan. And it's wound up being rather successful. But it also showed that that federal legislation was the way to go. And so that's why even when you go back to the 19 teens, 20s, and up until 1964 and the civil rights legislation, when you track the Dyer legislation, it's all about making these federal crimes and getting the federal government involved. And these are instruments put in place during Reconstruction.
So is this what Eisenhower and Kennedy used to help desegregate schools before we had the Civil Rights Act?
Well, it is. These are all tools in DOJ's basket.
So they felt that they could do this based on that they were on safe ground.
Yes.
Because we have these amendments. Sadly, I'll just go on a tangent here. It was also the 14th Amendment that made corporations human, and so
yes, yes, that's one of the
some blowback, as they call
yes,
it in the CIA.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's talk about something else you mentioned earlier. You talked about the movement to end slavery within African American communities. This is something that you are very serious about making sure we understand. And in fact, you've said Juneteenth probably shouldn't be the celebration of African-American liberation because it puts the emphasis on the wrong place. Tell us about your objections to Juneteenth celebration.
Juneteenth, as the legislation is written and has been passed by numerous states, says that on June 19th, 1865, that is when the word of the Emancipation Proclamation finally reached Texas. And the African-Americans there, the Negroes there, found out they were free. And so we want to celebrate this because these are the last to find out they were free. Well, there's a number of false statements here. First is that it didn't matter when you got the word of the Emancipation Proclamation. If the state wasn't brought back in the Union, the Emancipation Proclamation couldn't be enforced. So it didn't matter what you heard. What matters is whether it was enforced. Second is African-American soldiers were in Texas as early as November 1863 as a part of an invading force. And they're present.
Right.
So you're taking the African-American agency out of the story when you say that it's when the word got there. But most importantly, you're removing an understanding of, or let us say, you're creating an obstacle to understanding how the Emancipation Proclamation worked. Many Americans will say the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves on January 1, 1863. No, it did not. It declared free slaves in the states in rebellion. And Frederick Douglass wrote that in order for the Emancipation Proclamation to free the slaves, quote, we must have the ability to put down the rebellion, close quote. And African Americans understood this, and they're on board in league with the Constitution to save the Union, enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, and therefore emancipate themselves through the Emancipation Proclamation. And so that narrative of how the Emancipation Proclamation actually worked must be told accurately. And the agency of Americans of African descent in their own liberation must be told, because some of these stories are really fantastic American stories.
Well,
they are elevating, motivating American stories.
Share some of those with us, because I think that is something that we lack in the telling of this story, is the agency or the activism among African Americans to affect their own freedom.
Well, before the Civil War begins, 3 years before the Civil War begins, I'm just going to share a quote from Dr. John S. Rock. Dr. John S. Rock said, 3 years before the Civil War begins, March 5th, 1858, sooner or later, the clashing of arms will be heard in this country, and the black man's services will be needed. 150,000 freemen capable of bearing arms, and not all cowards and fools, and 750,000 slaves, wild with enthusiasm, caused by the dawn of the glorious opportunity of being able to strike a genuine blow for freedom, will be a power which the white man will be bound to respect. Will the blacks fight? Of course they will, close quote. So here we are 3 years before the Civil War begins. And Dr. Rock, one of the leaders in this African-American movement that believes in league with the Constitution that can end the tyranny of slavery, is promising 150,000 arm-bearing men to the Union and 750,000 slaves to aid in the Union war effort. That's actually a very accurate forecast of what the Union actually gets.
Also, Doug, I don't know if you're going to continue that thought, but you talked earlier about the black abolitionist movement. Tell us more about that and what was going on.
Dr. Rock would be one of the examples of that. The movement, when it really gains its, I'm going to call it trackability, where you can really track what they're up to, in particular their alliance with the Constitution and the belief that this is going to come to a clash of arms, there's going to be violence, starts in Buffalo in 1843. At the National Convention of the American Society of Free Persons of Color, and Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, originally born in Maryland but grew up in New York, and he delivers a speech, says, "Brethren, arise, arise, strike for your lives and liberty." And he goes on to say that we should use all means that promise success. And the key here is we should use all means that promise success. And the argument is that we should align ourselves at that time with the Liberty Party because they believe that the Constitution is essentially anti-slavery. We're going to align ourselves with the Liberty Party, and we're going to prepare ourselves to strike a blow for liberty in league with the Constitution. And so it becomes very trackable in 1843. In 1854, the Republican Party is formed, and you actually have a number of meetings throughout the states where they're talking about how they're going to work with the Republican Party for this same purpose. And so some of the names that come up that are really quite big and closer to the organization are Salmon P. Chase and William Seward. Lincoln is a name that you can find, but it's mostly in very esoteric circles. Mm. So Chase is more prominent.
Harry Jones is an independent history consultant. He will be at Fayetteville State University on Tuesday, June 19th. You can find out about his talk, How the Civil War Made America Great, at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you for joining us, Harry.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.